Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, the threat of the coronavirus is changing society. Colleges are trying to teach without face-to-face interaction. We'll hear about the challenges facing some professors. The blood supply is getting low as blood drives are being canceled. We'll hear more about that. And also learn how an arts organization is getting creative to keep producing shows. The run on grocery stores has led to a call for people to avoid panic buying. And with all that going on, are you feeling a lot of stress right now? You're not alone.
It's normal when we've got something like this going on that's so abnormal that people are going to feel, you know, some sense of anxiety, apprehension, potentially being overwhelmed, not sure what to do and how to handle things. You know, that is really a normal response.
The hospital has opened an emotional support hotline. We'll hear about it. That and more coming up on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll talk about the response to coronavirus in communities across Illinois. It's led to blood drives being canceled, and that could mean a drop in the blood supply. Arts organizations are trying to find ways to keep going, and we'll also hear what the retail industry is saying about the run on grocery stores. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. The coronavirus pandemic is especially impacting the hospitality industry. Bars and restaurants have been ordered closed, at least for a time. Also, conventions have canceled, travel slowing, and hotels in Illinois have seen a dramatic drop in bookings. Michael Jacobson is president of the Illinois Hotel and Lodging Association. He says some hotels in downtown Chicago are seeing occupancy rates in the single digits.
And anytime you fall below 35 or 30% in occupancy, it's hard for a hotel to justify keeping their lights on and keeping their doors open.
Jacobson says nationwide, the industry is on pace to lay off 1 million workers over the next week. He also expects more hotel closures in the coming days. Up next, a global pandemic interrupting daily routines. We're not talking about the coronavirus. Now we're looking back more than a century when what was referred to as Spanish flu resulted in deaths worldwide. I talk with reporter Tara McClellan McAndrew about her article for Illinois Issues. So Tara, with this current pandemic, you felt it was a good time to look back over 100 years ago to what happened in this influenza outbreak.
Yes, but we want to emphasize the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic is not the same virus as the current coronavirus. It is not the same virus. And we are not saying by looking at the 1918 pandemic that this is how the coronavirus is going to go. We have no idea what the coronavirus is going to look like ultimately. So we don't want anybody to listen to this story and think, oh, we're saying that it's going to get as bad as the 1918 pandemic was. We're not. We just thought it would be interesting to look back at what was the most recent worst pandemic that the world has seen, and that would be the 1918 flu outbreak. That flu was often referred to as the Spanish flu. It's not exactly known why it got that name, but the theory is that Spain was hit particularly hard by this flu, and that might be why it's gotten that moniker.
So what was the impact at that time? It was widespread, I know, and it was quite dramatic.
Exactly. The CDC estimates that one out of every three people on Earth got the disease. They say that a conservative estimate is that 50 million people around the world died. It's hard to know exactly how many died because there are some areas where there was not much or there was poor record keeping.
And here in Illinois, we also saw the impact.
We certainly did. Current estimate is that approximately 23,500 Illinoisans died. A sad footnote to that pandemic story is that it occurred during World War I, and more of our servicemen died because of the flu than died in combat. One of the reasons for this is that the soldiers, both when they were here at stations and base camps, training, preparing to go for the war, they were in pretty tight quarters, right? So that increases the spread. And then when they were shipped overseas, they were also often in situations where they were in close quarters, and some of them were even dying in transport overseas. And then, of course, when they were in battle in the war, some of them were actually in the trenches. It was trench warfare then. And those were very tight quarters and very unhygienic circumstances.
During your research, you uncovered a lot of personal stories and quite graphic details. And some, you know, share a couple of those if you could.
Okay. And let's emphasize that these stories were the worst of the worst, right? These were the extreme cases. These were not typical, but there are some very poignant ones. In Chicago, there were situations I read about where whole families would come down with the flu. In one case, there was a family of five, and the mother and the four children got very bad cases of it. And the father went out wandering the streets trying to find a doctor who could help his family, and he couldn't, and he committed suicide. Another case, there were other similar stories in Chicago to that. Another case was a tiny Native Alaskan village called Brevig Mission, and within 5 days in 1918, 72 of their 80 inhabitants died from the flu. So that, again, too, these are extreme cases, but the flu really hit people hard. I can tell you a personal case. My great-grandmother lost her son, who was, I think, 11 years old at the time, to the flu. This was 1 year after her husband had died in a mining accident. And my grandmother, who was the sister to the boy who died and was a child at the time, told me about, back then, wakes were held in the home. And she remembers the body being there, and she went up to touch it, and it was cold, and how afraid that made her and how sad that made her. And too, a side note to this, in some cities, because of the flu, funerals, public funerals, were either prohibited in some cities. In Springfield, they were restricted, and they had to be held like on your porch. So there were some extreme, what we might consider extreme, precautions taken to try to prevent the spread.
We're talking about the 1918 flu pandemic. But again, as you mentioned, we are seeing similar types of precautions being taken now due to the coronavirus. We are seeing people being told not to gather in large groups. I think you wrote about back over 100 years ago, some universities closed. Other things were prevented from happening as well.
Yes, in some cases, in some cities, dances were shuttered. In some cases, schools were shuttered. Interestingly, in Springfield, the capital, bowling alleys and bar rooms were allowed to remain open for at least for a while, as long as they got enough fresh air. Fresh air was thought to be at least a preventive or a cure at that time in 1918. But there were some other interesting measures that were taken. And again, sometimes cities differed in the measures they took. But some of them developed what I call hygiene patrols. For instance, in New York City, Boy Scouts would kind of patrol the streets, and if they saw someone spitting, they would give them a card that says, "You're breaking the sanitary code." In certain cities, if the police saw someone coughing or sneezing and not covering their face, they would go up and either tell them to go home, or if in one city, if that person gave them a hard time, they would actually arrest them. And one of the biggest concerns with the 1918 flu pandemic was developing a secondary infection, especially of pneumonia. So in Springfield, people were told that if you know of anyone who might have pneumonia, report them. You had to, you know, rat out your friends.
When I look back at this story, 1918 we're talking about, and even though it was so long ago and I didn't live through it, of course, I've heard about it through the years. It still seems as though it's in our societal consciousness. And every time the words pandemic, outbreak, those types of things, you know, get mentioned, it seems as though we think back to this. A lot of people do, at least. And that's where a lot of that concern comes from.
Yes. But again, let's emphasize, this is the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. This is not the current coronavirus pandemic, different viruses. We don't know what's going to happen with the coronavirus, and we don't know if it will in any way, shape, or form reach the spread and severity that the 1918 flu pandemic did. But the flu pandemic is kind of a high watermark, if you will, for how bad things can get, at least in recent history. And the stories can be pretty compelling and sad and frightening. But we know more now, and they knew so little about the flu in general back then that some of the doctors I quoted from oral histories of that time talk about how they thought fresh air was going to help the flu victims. So you had these hospitals where flu patients were, and they had to keep the windows open all the time, which probably just made them feel worse. So one interesting thing that has happened recently relating to the 1918 flu pandemic is that in 1997, a scientist traveled to this little Alaskan village called Brevik Mission that lost almost all of its 80 inhabitants during the 1918 flu. And it excavated the graves of some of those victims, and it found one woman who died from it, whose lungs had been perfectly preserved in the permafrost. Scientists used her lungs to study the genes of the virus to learn more about its origins and effects. And then later, other scientists even reconstructed a live version of the 1918 virus from that at the CDC headquarters in Atlanta under very, very careful and highly sanitized and controlled conditions. And that you can read about that on the CDC website. It's really interesting.
One of the things I was unaware of was, of course, we've heard about 1918, but I did not realize that the influenza pandemic continued. There were three waves of it. It continued until 1919. People were still dying in 1919.
That's correct. The 1918 Spanish flu pandemic really lasted from the spring of 1918, when the first not-so-bad wave hit, through that fall when the really bad second wave hit. And then it came back a third time in the winter and summer of 1919. So we weren't finished with it until the end of summer 1919. It came back and back again. The second wave was the worst in the fall of 1918.
I talked with reporter Tara McClellan McAndrew, who wrote about the flu pandemic more than a century ago. Her full story, a link to that, available at statewideshow.com. The current situation where schools and businesses are closing, it's also impacting the arts. One organization known as Theater in the Park has come up with a clever approach as it plans for the future. It holds productions in Lincoln's New Salem State Park in central Illinois, and normally auditions would be taking place in front of directors as parts get cast for the summer shows, but not right now. Not to be deterred, Theater in the Park is holding virtual auditions through video submissions or FaceTiming with a director. Adam Reich is the Theater in the Park board president, and I talked with him about that. There's a lot of creativity in the arts community. This is a creative approach to a problem that everyone is dealing with right now. That's the way I'd view it. Can you give me your thoughts on that?
Definitely. You know, as you said earlier, the show must go on. And, you know, with the arts, you just kind of have to roll with the punches and work with the situations that you're given, especially live theater. You know, no performance is ever the same. So it's definitely going to be a challenge, I think, for the directors, since they won't be able to see the actors in person. But I think that the directors will be able to cast the best that they can.
That's a challenge you mentioned for the directors. I'm guessing it's a challenge as well for those who are auditioning because, again, they're not face-to-face with someone.
I guess, yeah, not being able to get that direction on what the director is specifically looking for in reading a line in a specific way or singing a song a specific way or anything like that is really hard when you're not going to be able to get that live feedback from them.
Theater in the Park, like a lot of small arts groups, really they need the ability to raise money. Of course, you need the ability to put on shows and have tickets sold for those as well and other fundraisers. But is it creating that similar problem for your group as far as financial concerns right now?
Right now it's not. We did have a fundraiser that was scheduled for March 21st. A dinner theater that we postponed that until May 2nd. So hopefully that will help us financially, because we'll have more time to advertise that if we're able to go forward with that. So as of right now, we haven't been affected, but I guess we'll just have to see where things go and how much longer coronavirus affects the community.
And for those people who do want to set up an opportunity virtually to do an audition, what's the process that you ask them to go through?
They can go on our website, theaterinthepark.net, and each show is listed there. And the directors have set up what's called a Sign Up Genius account. They'll click on that, and they can contact the director for specific information on how the director wants to proceed. Some directors want to do just a FaceTime live on April 4th. Others want ahead of time video submissions. But the best thing is just to go on our website, or also our Facebook page has all the information as well. I think that, you know, it's just it's a rough time, and, you know, the show must go on. So we are making the show go on in the best way that we can.
Adam Reich is president of the Theater in the Park Board. The organization hosts performances in Lincoln's New Salem State Park each summer. Right now, they are hosting virtual auditions and planning, as he said, for the show to go on when the time is right. Maybe some good news. Farmers and ranchers in the U.S. who raise beef cattle have been increasing their production, and that could mean domestic consumers will see some slightly lower prices. Iowa State University livestock economist Lee Schultz says it also means beef producers are ready to take advantage of new and revised trade deals.
They all have the potential to be major players for U.S. products. Now, I think the kink that's been put in all of this is the COVID-19 and the potential impact that this is going to cause.
But he says there seems to be some progress in the phase one deal with China now, after the disease stalled trade because workers were locked out of ports and other work sites. You're listening to Statewide. Coming up, professors have to adapt to online teaching. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Illinois Funeral Directors Association says services should be limited to 10 or fewer people for the time being. Greg Henderson, the association's president, says that's to comply with current Centers for Disease Control coronavirus guidelines on large public gatherings.
Funeral directors across the area will work with families to try to accommodate their needs. We recommend to have embalming when they want to have a viewing, such as before cremation.
Henderson recommends small graveside services for now and says larger memorial masses or services can be held once the coronavirus has passed and things return to a state of normalcy. Meanwhile, at schools across the state, essential workers are showing up each day to feed their students, and this while Illinois classrooms remain closed. Lee Gaines with Illinois Newsroom reports school cafeteria workers are going to nearly empty school buildings every weekday to prepare meals to go, both breakfast and lunch. And in some places, teachers and administrators are helping with the delivery.
Donnell Mahan is an essential employee. She manages the cafeteria inside Chatham Elementary, a K-4 grade school in the small town south of Springfield. While most teachers and administrators aren't in the building, Mahan is still going to work.
Well, I've always thought that my job was one of the most important jobs in the world.
Mahan says this job is a calling for her. She started her career as a nurse, but she spent the last 29 years working in food service for the Ball Chatham School District. And she's on a mission to feed her students, even when they're not in school.
Because the kids need to be fed. They have to be fed. And so that's why we were there, to provide this.
Each school day, Mahan and two co-workers make pre-packaged meals. Families drive their cars to a door at the back of the school building, and Mahan and her colleagues hand the bagged meals through the driver's side window. She also makes sure she asks if they need more, since not every family can do a pickup every day.
You say, okay, now, is that all you need? And they'll say, well, I said, no, if you need more, please tell us. we told the lady, if you feel like you're not going to be able to come, you know, for 2 days in a row, then we'll give you that to go ahead and, you know, provide for your family. And this person was extremely thrilled.
Other Illinois school districts are also trying to gauge what families need. In Chicago's northwest suburbs, Ben Collins is principal at Maine South High School. In his district, families sign up ahead of time for meals and pick them up. Collins says they may start delivering meals soon. He says it's an evolving situation.
If this continues long term, this is only going to get worse for people who, you know, have food needs.
That's something that's weighing on the minds of school officials across the state. Like Jonathan Green, he's the superintendent of Meridian Community Unit School District. It's a rural district that encompasses nearly 100 square miles in southern Illinois. Families in Green's district are poor. In fact, every student qualifies for free meals from school.
We have to feed all of our kids no matter what. And I mean, I know all the other districts are supposed to feed their kids if they can, but we have to.
And here's how they're doing that. Green and other district staff members ride school buses to neighborhood bus stops where they deliver meals to students. Green worries about his students. He says the community has few resources and just a single gas station between the towns his district serves. But Green is heartened by all the people who want to help.
We're supposed to socially distance ourselves. That just means physical contact. It doesn't mean we can't help each other out and to make sure that we're taking care of the people who are around us.
Green plans to ride the school buses every day to deliver food to his students as long as schools remain closed. Green says at least that way he'll get to see them. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
As college professors across the state and the country scramble to prepare to shift classes online, Kate McGee of member station WBEZ in Chicago talked with some professors about how that transition is going.
Professor Daniel Stanford has spent the past 14 years at DePaul University creating trainings and resources for faculty members, including a whole section about teaching remotely. So when the university announced this week it was shifting all classes online due to the new coronavirus, he and his colleagues were ready to help.
I just did a webinar last night with around 40 faculty who wanted to learn the basics of video conferencing. And right now, we're just constantly creating new little mini trainings or quick resources for folks based on the questions that we're getting.
All this week, they've held webinars like this one, so faculty are ready to continue their semesters from a distance.
The method I'm showing you right now for creating discussions is the simplest and fastest way to create discussions.
Most universities in Illinois are extending spring break, so faculty have more time to shift their courses online. A majority of colleges already have online learning systems for email, discussion boards, or to upload assignments. But grading and assignments online are different than instruction. And that's what many faculty have questions about, says Stanford.
How do I translate this discussion I normally do in the classroom into something that's engaging online?
The transition is especially tough for professors who still use a paper syllabus and rely on classroom discussions for grading. There wasn't a lot of time to prepare for this sudden change, says Janet Smith, who teaches at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
There's some learning curve, and so there are many faculty who were trying to learn really quickly in the last few days how to use these tools.
Kevin Pitts is a vice provost at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where they're shifting about 5,000 courses online. Faculty can choose instruction styles from extra written assignments to live video conferences.
Some faculty will continue to teach in the classroom, but the classroom will be empty, but there will be a video camera recording the lecture.
One popular video conference program is called Zoom, but it requires all students can get on a computer at the same time. And faculty members are concerned about low-income students.
My college, for example, was polling the students yesterday quickly, like, who needs a laptop? Who doesn't have a laptop? And then I said, well, what about the internet? And like, oh, yeah, we don't know who has internet connection.
That's Janet Smith at UIC again. All University of Illinois campuses will remain open so students can access the library and computer labs, but that could require traveling on public transit to get to campus and further expose students to the virus. Pitts at U of I says they're still figuring out how to handle that.
We're looking at ways to try to ensure that they can get material and it's not required for them to be doing kind of real-time live video content, because that we know that will be uneven at very best.
Plus, there are some classes that are just much more difficult to teach online, like science labs or performing arts classes. Faculty and administrators say they might utilize video to share dance or studio art assignments. In a science lab, professors might share data from previously completed experiments that students can analyze, even if they didn't conduct the experiment themselves. Stanford at DePaul says at the end of the day, professors shouldn't be too hard on themselves as they grapple with this tough transition.
This is hopefully an opportunity to not let perfect be the enemy of good, to let everyone view this as an experiment and a learning opportunity, and to be really honest with our students that we're all learning.
And as courses resume remotely in the next few weeks, it's likely there will only be more issues to address. Kate McGee, WBEZ News.
This is Statewide. Pictures and videos of people panic buying supplies at grocery stores have flooded social media. Many say they're stocking up as life grinds to a halt in an effort to stop the COVID-19 pandemic from getting worse. Reporter Sam Dunklaw sought out some perspective on all that. He spoke with Rob Carr, who represents about 23,000 Illinois retailers, as the CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Carr says store owners are urging residents to stay calm during the crisis.
Rob, talk to me a little bit about what you're hearing from members right now. I know in the last couple of days, even the last week, people have been making a run on stores to grab all kinds of supplies because life, really, as we know it in the state of Illinois and even in the rest of the country, is shutting down. So what are you hearing from members? I mean, have you seen anything like this?
Have not seen anything really like this before, other than perhaps in advance of a snowstorm, which is a much different dynamic. I think what's disappointing is people are engaging in panic buying and hoarding when they really don't need to be. There is nothing about this crisis that requires that response, and they're putting an unnecessary strain on the supply chain that doesn't need to be there.
So what do you do to assure people that at this time, you know, you don't need to make a trip to buy 4 cases of toilet paper?
Right. Yeah, I find the toilet paper interesting because it's not like we're dealing with a disease that or a sickness that affects you that way. But regardless, nowhere in the world has anybody shuttered grocery stores or pharmacies or the like. So there's always going to be access to food. There's manufacturers are making it. We've worked with Governor Pritzker's office, with Washington, with local governments like Mayor Lightfoot's office, to remove any obstacles that might be in the way of smooth distribution. So really now we just need the consumer to recognize their role and return to their normal shopping pattern.
So when you say normal shopping pattern, are you saying that folks need to just go to the stores they normally would?
Correct. So let's say, for an example, you shop on a Thursday for the following week. Do that. Shop for the following week. Don't buy for 3 weeks. There's no reason or cause for concern for that. No one's shuttering grocery stores. No one's cutting off access to food. All you have to do is be smart when you go shopping. Maintain a little bit of social distance, 6 feet. Wash your hands. Things you should do every day, regardless of whether there's a coronavirus outbreak or not.
Surely, Rob, your members are probably seeing an influx of business with people streaming into stores, as we've seen. Is that good or bad for members in a situation like this?
Well, it's both. I mean, it's always good to see sales, but nobody wants to see sales, increase sales as a result of this. They want to see increased sales in a normal course of life. But it's also very taxing. You're paying a lot of extra overtime. People are having to work extra hours, and so it puts a strain on everyone.
Talk to me a little bit about some of the supply chain issues that have been pointed out. What's being done to resolve, what we're seeing in the media, pictures on social media, videos showing stores with almost nothing on their shelves.
Sure. So we worked with the Illinois Municipal League and Governor Pritzker's office and Mayor Lightfoot's office to remove, to convince municipalities to remove ordinances or to suspend ordinances that restricted when you could deliver. So municipalities have ordinances that say, for example, you can't deliver between the hours of 9 and 7 or something like that. So we removed those. Those are temporarily suspended. The federal government increased the hours that truck drivers can work. So those restrictions are removed. We are awaiting word of increasing truck weight limits in the state of Illinois. Those three actions alone will enable up to a 15% increase in the amount that we can get to stores. And then we're also working with the Department of Labor on a couple issues around the distribution centers, but we expect those to be resolved as well.
Are you worried at all that the infrastructure in place for retailers, grocery stores, and the like are going to be able to handle that influx? I mean, can workers handle the surge in demand that we're seeing?
No, I think they're showing they can handle it. They are keeping up with it. I think that's also one reason you're seeing some stores that are, for example, open 24 hours are now rolling back their hours a little bit. They're closing. Some have announced they're closing like 11 or midnight and opening at 6 the next morning. That gives them time to clean the store more thoroughly as well as restock more appropriately. It's just, again, a simple question of the consumer has to return to their normal shopping patterns and not buy into this unwarranted panic.
Want to zero in on a couple of these specifics that we were just talking about. How many communities have ordinances on when you can deliver? Is that broadly across the state? Are there specific places where that's in place?
We have no good numbers on that. I know that Chicago had a very robust one, and they immediately responded and suspended all of their restrictions. I know some of the suburban communities and a couple of downstate communities had some, but I don't know how widespread it was. But again, great credit to the Municipal League. Brad Cole is their executive director, and he's been extraordinarily helpful.
And as for the driving limits that are placed on truckers, weight limits, what were those? What have they been raised to?
So the driving truck limits are now at the discretion of the driver, him or herself. When the president issued his emergency order, that automatically suspended that. The weight limits, we're just awaiting word from the state. I know there was a coordinated meeting this morning between Illinois and some surrounding states to see what they want to raise it to. They're trying to get a uniform number. I think Wisconsin and Missouri had raised theirs 10%. Indiana, I think it issued a permit approach. So we're just waiting word on that.
So I want to make a differentiation, and I hate to do this, between essential businesses like grocery stores and maybe some non-essential ones. Surely the next couple of weeks, maybe even the next couple of months, are going to be tough on them. What assurances have you been giving those businesses on, you know, what to do now?
Yeah, we can't give them really any assurances at this time. You're absolutely right. There's going to be tremendous strain. It hurts my stomach to even think about this, but let alone say it, but I think we will see some businesses close and not return, particularly the longer this goes. It's just a question of margin and lack of sales, and so there's really no assurance to give them yet, other than that we, on behalf of the industry, and certainly I know firsthand, the government is doing everything they can to minimize the impact of all, while letting the facts and the science drive decision-making.
So last thing, when do you think we're going to see things go back to normal at the grocery store?
Yeah, when it goes back to full normal, I don't know. I would defer to the medical experts on that, and I am certainly not a medical expert. So I would defer to them on that. But I think we'll see some normalcy return with the obstacles we remove from the supply chain. And then if we are successful in getting consumers to think a bit more rationally about how they're going about making their grocery purchases, they're going to continue to have access to restaurants, albeit you can't go out and sit in the restaurant, but you'll certainly have options to order food there as well. There's going to be no shortage of food. We really just need people to return to their normal shopping patterns. And I think if we do that, the next couple of weeks are not going to be bad.
That's the Illinois Retail Merchants Association CEO Rob Carr talking with Sam Dunklaw about the influx of panic buying as Illinois continues to deal with the global pandemic. crisis is statewide, why there are concerns about the blood supply. That story's next. Listening to Statewide, I'm Sean Crawford, helping people cope with stress during the coronavirus pandemic. That and more on the way. All the focus right now is on staying put, not going out unless necessary, and that can create problems for the blood supply. There's an urgent call for blood donors. I talked with Jim Watts. He's with the Central Illinois Community Blood Center. He's also president of the Illinois Coalition of Community Blood Centers.
We understand people's caution and reservation. However, our main message is that there are officials, FDA, still encouraging people to come out and give blood, as we are doing everything we can to prevent a shortage of blood products. Currently, some elective surgeries have been postponed, and we want to make sure that we can help that impact so there's not very much of an impact on the blood for our hospitals.
So is the problem showing up now, or are you seeing a concern going forward?
So the problem is now and going forward. So in Central Illinois, we've had hundreds of locations cancel, which can mean thousands of blood donations. And that's because, of course, our high schools are closed. There are other businesses that are closing, having people work from home. So those donors are not coming to our mobile blood sites. And so we see this as an issue right now, but then we also will have this issue for the next 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, you know, depending on how long some of these restrictions are in place for social distancing. We will see this for weeks and perhaps months to come.
I know a lot of doctors, you mentioned, are postponing elective surgery. Even some doctor's office visits are being postponed right now, and dentists have canceled their appointments. So when we're hearing all of that, what makes somebody feel as though they can be safe going to donate blood?
Sure. So first and foremost, we are only asking healthy individuals to come out and donate. So it's not like going to the grocery store where anyone could be. We are asking only people who are healthy to come out. And then, we're screening those individuals to make sure that they are healthy before they go on to the blood donation process. We are making sure and implementing local, state, and federal guidelines for social distancing. So even coming to these blood drives, we have precautions out there to make sure that our donors and our staff are safe.
Are you having any issues with staff not being able to come in, not wanting to come in, possibly?
You know, at this time, we are not seeing those staffing issues. We have a wide variety of people that are still coming to work. And with a lot of our mobile support, our mobile staff not being able to go out to some of these canceled blood drives, we've actually been able to have an increase of staff come to our donor centers and be able and ready to help.
Normally, when I hear that there is a need for blood, maybe it's after a natural disaster, or maybe the supply has gotten so low, the response from the community is often pretty overwhelming. People want to chip in, they want to do their part and come and help. These are unique circumstances, though, so it is more of a challenge, isn't it?
It is. This is unlike anything that we've seen in the past. So when there is a call to action after a natural disaster or perhaps a man-made disaster, we do see donors come out. Right now, some of the hesitation is with other guidelines that are out there, including the social distancing. However, that's why we're talking, to make sure that people understand, while those are guidelines out there, we still need a safe, adequate blood supply, and so we still need those individuals to come out and donate.
So if somebody is coming out, if somebody wants to come out, you mentioned a lot of these blood drives at businesses and other locations have been canceled. How do they do it? Where do they go? How do they get in touch with someone?
So anyone interested in donating blood can go to bloodcenter.org. That is for our organization, Central Illinois Community Blood Center, which is a division of Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center. And so our blood centers span from the Quad Cities area over to Danville, up to Ottawa, and down to the Metro East area. If someone throughout the state wanted to find a location to donate blood, they could go to americasblood.org. That is America's Blood Centers. That's a national organization that community blood centers belong to. So we are asking for donors to make and keep their appointments and for blood drive hosts to keep their commitments to hosting blood drives so we can ensure an adequate supply.
So even businesses that might be trying to close down a bit more, if they can host a blood drive, that would still be what you're looking at.
If they could host a blood drive, let's say that they have sent their workers home to work from home, messaging for them to go to the local blood center and donate blood. So first and foremost, for them to keep them if they have the donors there. But if the office is closed down and there's no one there, at least for them to encourage their employees and granting them permission to go give blood.
Jim Watts is president of the Illinois Coalition of Community Blood Centers. And if you want to find out where to give blood, there are links at our website, statewideshow.com. With Illinois residents practicing isolation inside their homes, the marijuana industry is making adjustments to meet consumer needs. Mike Smith has details.
While Governor J.B. Pritzker prescribes isolation as a method of reducing the spread of COVID-19, the marijuana industry is staying open for business. Illinois Cannabis Association's Pam Althoff says the industry is meeting the governor's restrictions head-on with initiatives like curbside delivery.
We are doing everything to ensure their accessibility to medicine and, more importantly, their safety in getting the access to that medicine.
Althoff says the marijuana industry is following guidelines that include disinfecting surfaces touched by patients and separating customers based on recreational or medical consumption. Governor Pritzker said he would look at dispensaries in the same light and venue as pharmacies. I'm Mike Smith.
There's a lot of concern over the coronavirus, but should pet owners be worried? Steph Whiteside tells us more.
As far as scientists know right now, pets don't get sick from the form of coronavirus that causes COVID-19, but they can carry the virus on their fur or collars. So if you're in isolation or quarantine, be careful about letting others interact with your cat or dog, says Olivia Rudolphi, veterinarian and president of the Illinois State Veterinary Medicine Association. She says owners should limit canine playdates or visits to dog parks and avoid petting other people's pets. Rudolphi also recommends disinfecting leashes, collars, and beds your pet has used after it's been outside. Finally, Rudolphi reminds people not to use Lysol or other disinfectants on their pets. If you're worried about your pet carrying coronavirus, a bath with regular pet shampoo will work just fine. I'm Steph Whiteside.
Stress and anxiety, there is plenty of it right now, and quite often it helps to talk through it. A Central Illinois healthcare operation has launched a free emotional support hotline. Diana Kanabi is administrator of behavioral health for Memorial Health System, and I spoke with her.
We did hear from folks at the Crisis Text Line, which is a national texting service, that they were getting lots of calls and to, you know, remind folks that it's normal when we've got something like this going on that's so abnormal that people are going to feel, you know, some sense of anxiety, apprehension, potentially being overwhelmed, not sure what to do and how to handle things, you know, that is really a normal response. And so felt like anything that we could do to try to both help our own internal colleagues, but then also being able to allow the regular general public to be able to make the call as well.
So you mentioned it is normal for people to feel anxious in mm-hmm. times like these, certainly. What can you do to help somebody, especially when they call in?
Make sure they're taking precautions and that they are being safe, but that you're doing good things for yourself and or your family during this time. And, you know, it could be because people are at home and they're at home, you know, for longer periods of time. you know, with family members maybe that they don't spend as much time with, and that that might also, you know, be causing some difficulty. And so they may need to know, how do I negotiate with my family or people that I live with in ways that might be more productive and helpful, and what to do with their time. You know, what are productive ways to be able to spend their time? I think exercising and again, eating well. And it may be that people don't know what resources are out there, you know, and that's another concern. And we've been collecting a lot of both local and national resources that might be helpful for folks, either, you know, web information or places if kids are needing food or even adults are needing food, where can they go if they don't have the finances to be able? Or even I'm seeing that, you know, some of the grocery stores are changing, you know, time so that they have availability for seniors and those with more, you know, health compromises to be able to go in for alternative hours into grocery stores and those kinds of things. So people may be calling, you know, when can I get out? What can I do? How do I make sure that I'm safe and that I'm keeping my family safe?
Are there certain things people should be considering, maybe in their home or working from home? They're there all the time. Certainly they can go outside of their house. They can get some fresh air if that's possible. Exercise, things of that nature. Does that help with some of these feelings?
Yes, yes. Exercise either in the home or outside. I think the main thing is making sure that you're not in a crowded area. As we've been hearing, you know, I think in general we're, you know, adhering to less than 10 people and staying at least 6 feet apart. Obviously, if you're showing symptoms yourself, you probably will want to stay in and not go outside. And so if you're having flu-like symptoms, you know, it may be better to stay inside unless you can go out on a deck or something where there really aren't other people around. I think it's harder then as people are inside more and the sun isn't shining, it's grayer, you know, in general. I think that makes us all feel a little bit less optimistic and enthusiastic. And so, you know, the vitamin D that we get from sunshine is also a healing, you know, so it is nice to be able to get outside some.
Life itself is full of anxious moments, and sometimes they're personal moments and sometimes not. But have you ever seen anything quite like this situation now as far as the number of people that are feeling this way and the confusion that a lot of people have and anxiousness that's out there?
Not to this magnitude, that's for sure. And I think, you know, learning to breathe is important and continuing to breathe and take care of oneself, eating well, getting some sleep. And again, exercise, whether it's walking around your home, your apartment, if you can't get outside. Obviously, if you've got physical health issues, you need to be wary of that as well. You know, sometimes just sitting in a chair and being able to move around that way can be helpful as well.
I'm in the news business, and of course people need to stay informed of what's going on, but sometimes do people need to unplug a little bit from what's happening?
Yes, and I think certainly making sure, that's an excellent point, that they're looking at reliable sources as well. I think the CDC and the World Health Organization are certainly some of the places to stay up to date. But, you know, keeping yourself plugged in and looking at that, I think, can often, you know, also, you know, lead to worry and those kinds of things. And so I think looking for, you know, what's been okay today, you know, gratitude journals or something that can be very helpful. What are folks noticing that's different? You know, hear the birds sometimes, you know, just unplugging and listening, or listening to some soothing music might be helpful, taking a warm bath, something that can kind of help you just to relax, can be most beneficial for all of us, I think, as well.
We're talking about this hotline, emotional support hotline. People can be helped, of course, in some cases. You might be able to help them over the phone, but there are oftentimes they may need additional help, and that's being offered as well. You're referring people that might feel the need for additional services.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, if people are, you know, feeling ultimately suicidal, and, you know, we want them to obviously call 911 or call the National Suicide Hotline, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Those can be really good resources. There's a couple of good resources that are out there. NAMI.org, which is the National Alliance for Mental Illness, and the National Mental Health Association, to help folks to be able to be more positive in taking care of their own behavioral health, which is very, very important. If we're not taking care of our behavioral health, it will impact our physical health, and we certainly want people to be as physically healthy as they can be.
Diana Kanabi is administrator of behavioral health at Memorial Health System. She talked about a free emotional support hotline. We have the number for that and other resources at our website at statewideshow.com. That wraps up this episode of Statewide. You can find us at statewideshow.com and also on Facebook. Just look for Statewide Show. We'll be back again next week with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. In the meantime, stay safe and stay put if possible. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.